Hey everyone, welcome back. Ready for another deep dive? Today, we're really going to dig into dyslexia, like way beyond the surface level.
Definitely. It's a topic that often gets simplified, but it's much more nuanced than people realize.
Absolutely, and thankfully, we've got this fantastic document from the Alaska Department of Education to guide us. It's what, like 50 pages of research and insights?
Yeah, it's pretty comprehensive. And the best part is, it's written in a way that anyone can understand. No jargon overload here.
Music to my ears. So, where should we even start? Oh, I know, this statistic just blew my mind.
Hit me with it.
Okay, so the document cites research saying that by fifth grade, some kids with dyslexia might have only read, get this, 50,000 words total, compared to 600,000 for their peers.
Wow, that is a massive gap, and it really highlights the urgency of why we need to get this right.
It's not even just about reading speed either, right?
Right, it has a domino effect.
Yeah.
The document connects those early reading struggles to later challenges with vocabulary, even comprehension down the line.
It's like, you know, if you're not building those foundational skills early on, it impacts everything else. And this document, it doesn't shy away from debunking some common myths.
Yeah, like that whole they just need to try harder myth.
Ugh, the worst, right?
The document shuts that down right away. It emphasizes that dyslexia, it's neurological, it's not a matter of effort.
Which makes total sense, but it's amazing how much that myth persists.
It really does. So to be clear, we're talking about differences in brain wiring, not willpower.
Precisely. So, how does this document actually define dyslexia? You know, in a way that cuts through all the noise.
Well, they break it down into four main points. It originates in the brain. That's the foundation. It involves difficulties with, recognizing words accurately and fluently.
So, like decoding, basically.
Exactly. It means their reading ability ends up lower than we'd expect based on their other cognitive abilities.
So, their intelligence isn't the issue at all.
Not at all. And that's the fourth point. It's not due to a lack of intelligence or effort.
Which has huge implications for how we approach teaching and support.
Absolutely. It changes the whole conversation from blame to understanding.
And to solutions. But before we get into all that, I do want to touch on something you mentioned earlier about how these reading difficulties can spill over into other areas.
Right, it's not always isolated to reading. The document talks about how dyslexia can impact writing, spelling, even a student's self-image. But we'll delve into that a bit later.
Definitely want to unpack that more, but first, let's take a look at how we actually identify dyslexia, because knowing the signs is crucial. Okay, so we've talked about what dyslexia is, but how do we actually spot it, you know, in the real world? This is where this document gets super practical. It gives you all these indicators of dyslexia across different grade levels.
It's like a roadmap to guide early identification and support. And having those clear indicators, it makes a world of difference.
Absolutely. And I know we can't go through every single one, but I did find one for the younger kids, like K through three, that just really struck me. It says here that difficulty remembering the names and shapes of letters can be an early sign, which at first glance, you might not even connect to dyslexia.
Right. You might just think, oh, they'll grow out of it.
Yeah.
But when you consider the neurological aspects we were just discussing, it makes total sense.
So tell me more about that connection. Like, how does that early struggle with letters tie back to the brain?
Well, research suggests that for some individuals with dyslexia, the area of the brain that handles, visual processing and connecting symbols to sounds, it works a little differently.
Yeah.
So they might see the letters just fine, but it's that linking, that mapping of the letter to its name or sound, that's where the challenge lies.
So it's like their brain is getting a bit tripped up on that translation from symbol to sound.
That's a great way to put it. It's like the wires are getting crossed somewhere along the way.
Fascinating. And it highlights why that early intervention is so important, right?
Yeah.
Because we're not just talking about memorizing letters, we're talking about how the brain is wired for language.
Exactly. Now, while this document really dives deep into reading, it also points out that dyslexia, it often doesn't show up alone.
Yeah.
You might see it alongside other learning differences. Like they specifically mention dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and auditory processing disorder.
So it's like a whole constellation of challenges sometimes. And I imagine that can make it even trickier to identify and support, right?
Absolutely, because you're not just addressing one thing in isolation.
Yeah.
Knowing how these challenges intersect, it's key. Let's take dysgraphia, for example, which they say often goes hand in hand with dyslexia.
So with dysgraphia, it's not just reading, but writing becomes a hurdle too.
Exactly. They might struggle with handwriting, spelling, even just getting their thoughts organized on paper. And again, those neurological differences we discussed, they play a huge role. Because think about it, if you're already having trouble processing and remembering letters and sounds, it's naturally going to affect your ability to write them down. It's like a chain reaction almost.
Makes sense. And I imagine facing these challenges day in and day out, it can take a toll on a student's self-esteem too.
Absolutely. Feeling like you're putting in the effort, but still lagging behind your classmates in reading and writing, it can be really discouraging. And that's why emotional support, building a child's confidence, it becomes just as important as any academic intervention. We can't just focus on the academic side of things.
You know, one thing I really appreciate about this document is that it doesn't just like outline the challenges, you know, it actually dives right into solutions. Like there's this whole section on effective teaching strategies for students with dyslexia.
Yeah.
It's really empowering.
Right. And it's not just throwing any old teaching method at the wall and hoping something sticks. The document really stresses the importance of using evidence-based practices. They even break down the specific criteria that make an approach evidence-based, you know, so it's clear.
I love that. No guesswork allowed. But for those of us who aren't, like, education researchers, what does that actually look like in the classroom? What are we talking about here?
Well, they highlight a few different approaches, but one example they give is explicit systematic phonics instruction.
Okay, yeah, I remember that term from earlier. So basically, just to refresh my memory, we're talking about...
It's basically a very structured, like, step-by-step approach to teaching the connections between letters and sounds.
Yeah.
Instead of just, you know, seeing a word and trying to memorize it, it's about breaking down the code, making those connections explicit.
It's not cracking code of reading.
Exactly. It's like giving them the tools to decode any word they come across.
Okay. That makes a lot more sense. Explicit, systematic, those words click now. But I'm curious, why is it so important that these approaches are evidence-based, especially for kids with dyslexia?
Well, I mean, think back to those neurological differences we talked about. Evidence-based practices, they're designed with those differences in mind. They acknowledge that students with dyslexia might need instruction that's tailored to how their brains are wired for language. You know,
yeah.
It's not one size fits all.
So we're talking about really personalized learning in a way.
Exactly. It's about finding what works for each individual student. And alongside effective instruction, the document also talks about accommodations as being a vital tool.
Yes. Accommodations. I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
Because that word can mean so many things to different people. So when we talk about accommodations, what are we really talking about in this context?
So in this context, accommodations are basically adjustments made to like how things are taught or how students access information. And it's all about making sure everyone has an equal opportunity to learn, right?
Okay, so leveling the playing field.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But here's a really important point. Accommodations, they don't lower expectations.
That's key, because I think some people hear accommodations and they think, oh, we're making it easier.
Yeah, and it's not about making it easier. It's about removing barriers, right? So everyone has a fair shot.
Love that. So what are some examples of accommodations? Like, what might that look like in a real classroom?
Sure. So they give a bunch of examples, but one type of accommodation is what we call material accommodations. So this could be things like using audiobooks or text-to-speech software so a student can listen to the content instead of just having to read it visually, you know.
Right. So providing different ways to access and engage with the information.
Exactly. And then you have instructional accommodations. So this could be like providing extra time for assignments or tests or allowing a student to respond verbally instead of having to write everything down.
So it's about recognizing that different learners might need different ways to show what they know, which makes so much sense.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this document, it doesn't just focus on teachers and classrooms.
Yeah.
There's this whole section dedicated to parents, to empowering parents as advocates for their children.
Which is so important, right? Because parents are often those first and most important advocates, especially when it comes to navigating these challenges. So what kind of guidance does this document offer to parents?
One thing that really stood out to me was the focus on open communication and collaboration between parents and educators.
Yeah.
They really encourage parents to be active participants in their child's education, whether it's attending those individualized education program meetings, the IEP meetings.
Right, where they talk about the student's specific learning needs and goals.
Exactly. Attending those meetings or even just staying informed about their child's progress, you know. It's about teamwork.
It's about working together, parents and educators, to support the student, right? Because they're all on the same team.
Exactly. And they even offer practical tips for parents on how to be effective advocates. things like keeping detailed records of their child's challenges and successes, and really understanding their rights under the law.
Knowledge is power, for sure. And I know we touched on this earlier about how dyslexia can impact a student's self-esteem, their confidence. Does the document address that emotional side of things too?
Oh, definitely. They emphasize the importance of addressing the emotional impact, for sure. You know, parents, they can play a huge role in nurturing your child's confidence and self-esteem.
Right, like celebrating their strengths, helping them develop a love of learning that goes beyond just, you know, reading and writing.
Yes, because it's about so much more than just academics, isn't it? It's about their whole sense of self.
Absolutely. Wow, we've covered so much ground in this deep dive. I mean, we've gone from understanding what dyslexia is and how it presents to exploring effective teaching strategies, the power of parents as advocates. It's been quite a journey.
It really has. And we've only just scratched the surface, but I do think this document is a fantastic starting point for anyone wanting to learn more about dyslexia and how to best support these learners.
I couldn't agree more. It's been so eye-opening, even for me, and I like to think I know a thing or two about this topic. So to our listeners, as you continue to learn and explore, I want to leave you with this. This document, it focuses on what's considered evidence-based right now today, but research is always evolving, right?
Always changing, always growing.
Exactly. So who knows what new discoveries and innovations are out there waiting to be uncovered. Just something to keep in mind as we continue advocating for inclusive learning environments for all. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.